Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, an analysis of ideology, propaganda, and race in Trump's America. With us is David Livingston Smith, professor of philosophy at the University of New England, and the author of four books, including Why We Lie, How Biology Shapes Philosophy, The Most Dangerous Animal, and Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, David Livingston Smith. It's great to have you back with us.
Oh, thank you, Maria. It's wonderful to be here.
You've been analyzing the U.S. president's speeches using the work from a paper written in 1941, The Psychology of Propaganda. First of all, why is this work from way back then important today?
Well, from the beginning, when I heard Trump and my well-meaning lefty friends thought, this man is a joke, you know, he's a buffoon, he's good for entertainment, I was concerned. Because listening to him from that very first speech he made when he announced his candidacy, there were echoes to me of the account published in this 1941 paper of the rhetorical style of Hitler and Goebbels. And listening to Trump, I found that, in fact, his rhetorical style, the approach that he used in his speeches, not just the first one, but almost all of the ones afterwards really conformed to the analysis of Nazi rhetoric that is presented in that paper to an extraordinary degree.
How would you describe that? What are the elements that you see as parallel?
Well, maybe I should give you a little bit of the backstory to the paper. The paper was written by a man named Roger Monicarl, who was a psychoanalyst, and had two PhDs, one in philosophy and one in anthropology. Monicarl was British, and after World War I, which he fought in, he enrolled in Cambridge University to study philosophy, and then went off to Vienna in the 1920s to do a PhD in philosophy under Moritz Schlick, very prominent philosopher, and to undergo analysis with Freud. A little bit later, he was invited by a friend of his, a man named Arthur Jenkin. He was Australian, but he was a British diplomat, to come to Germany and listen to Hitler and Goebbels. And what Monicarl did was to present in this 1941 paper an analysis of the pattern of rhetoric and the psychological effects of that rhetoric. So here's what Monicarl said. He said Hitler and Goebbels basically did this. They started out by evoking depression in their audience. That is, they presented Germany as having been betrayed by the German people. They pictured gloom and doom. So they talked about the humiliation of Germany after the Treaty of Versailles, how Germany had been brought to its knees, how the German people had betrayed their destiny, and so on and so forth. And once this approach elicited the sort of effect that they wanted it to elicit, which is what Monicarl called an orgy of self-pity, they changed their tune and they changed to a paranoid pattern. That is, they said, well, you know, it's not really you, it's the Jews, it's the communists, it's the international bankers. They are the enemies of Germany. They are responsible for our terrible state. Now, once he got his audience worked up into a paranoid frenzy, a sense of danger, he then offered the manic solution, as Monicarl called it. And that was, join the Nazi party, we can save Germany together. He calls on the German people to unite behind him and offers this, you know, hyped up magical solution to these problems. So as I listened to Trump, I found that this pattern repeated again and again. And it's a very, very powerful way of ensuring political persuasion.
When I read some of the material that you're talking about, I was wondering if maybe the emotions were slightly off. So, for example, the depression or the melancholy, I think, was the way it was articulated in the original paper.
Yeah.
I was thinking it potentially a baser type of emotion that was being evoked, not so much depression and melancholia as outrage and anger.
Well, the outrage and anger, I think, with Trump comes a little bit later in the sequence. So typically he starts by saying, we are a laughingstock. The Mexicans are smarter than us. The Chinese are smarter than us. We don't win anymore. We are losers. So there's a sense of diminution, of humiliation, of failure, which then gets replaced by this kind of idea that we have these Mexicans, rapists pouring into the country. We have the Muslims wanting to destroy us and so on. So it's at that moment that the tune changes to the paranoid tune. But of course, you know, Trump isn't Hitler. So what we're going to find is a different variant of the sort of thing that Hitler and Goebbels did in Germany in the 20s and 30s, one suited to the American situation.
I have been thinking about this. As you know, I also analyze language and framing and media. And I can remember a period of time when President Obama was elected that the right wing consistently, the very far right wing, consistently compared him to Hitler.
Yeah.
And so it became this easy person to go to and to link to. Do you think that this Hitler comparison sometimes goes too far?
Oh, of course. It's often done on the cheap. So what I've tried to do is offer a substantive comparison. Trump isn't Hitler. Trump isn't Mussolini. Trump isn't any of those people. Trump is Trump. But the pattern of rhetoric is uncannily similar to the pattern of rhetoric that was used by some of these people. So, you know, Trump is Hitler? Nah, Trump is Trump. But does Trump make the sort of moves that Hitler made, the sort of rhetorical moves? Absolutely. If we abstract away enough from the specific content.
Do you think that to a degree, a lot of political speeches, political leaders, people after winning an election or building a movement towards something like what Trump is doing, all use this type of pattern to some degree?
Yes, I do.
To what extent do you think that Donald Trump has taken this to another level?
I was curious about this. I decided to look back at Bernie Sanders' speeches. And we find something like this with Sanders, but it's no way as precise a replication of the Hitlerian rhetoric than we find with Trump. So Sanders doesn't cultivate these depressive and paranoid anxieties like Trump does. Of course, all politicians do this to some degree because they're proposing themselves as solutions to problems. So first, they have to identify the problems. And of course, it's only by evoking emotion that you get political persuasion. People aren't persuaded by careful, reasoned arguments. They're persuaded by the evocation of passion. Right? So that's one thing. The other thing is the degree to which the politician departs from reality. Right? So if we look at Obama and we look at Sanders, what we find is, yeah, sure, they do something like this. And they propose, I mean, it was very clear with Obama, proposing magical solutions, crowds of people chanting, you know, yes, we can. That's not an appeal to reason. That's magic. And that's this elation that comes from a crowd fusing together behind a person and an idea associated with that person. But the departure from reality in Trump's case is really quite stunning. And I think that makes a very, very important difference.
You mentioned something else that I want to get to, which was the departure. But just before we do that, I think perhaps one of the key differences between, say, Obama, Bernie Sanders, and Donald Trump is the Obama and Sanders rhetoric really tended to try to keep united and not to scapegoat and blame in the way that Donald Trump does. And I think that's a very important factor.
Yeah, that's right. So the evocation of depression and paranoia, to the extent that it's there, is really quite muted. And it's often undetectable, actually, if we look at their speeches. Whereas with Trump, it's very, very salient. And it still is salient. There is an appeal to unity by Trump, but it's an appeal to unity to fight against these terrible forces out to destroy us.
The thing I want to go back to is really related also to some of your earlier work on deception. And you had written a book on why we lie before. Your argument in your book was that this is really deeply embedded in our culture, deception and lying. But then when you look at Donald Trump and the degree to which the relationship to the truth is not really there at all, have we just gone off the rails as a culture?
You know, it's very popular to see Donald Trump as this erratic, crazy sort of guy. I don't think that's the case. First of all, I think he has an extraordinarily high degree of social intelligence. He understands what moves people, and he understands what he has to do to produce the effects that he wants. And he really does understand, I think, more profoundly than most politicians, that truth doesn't matter all that much in politics. What matters is stirring people up, is activating their emotions. So, you know, I think what we see in Trump is sort of almost a pure culture of a certain kind of political sensibility. Now, the United States was obviously prepared for that. So the United States was prepared in the sense that prepared, ripe is what I mean, ripe for someone whose connection with the truth and intellectual responsibility is far, far, far more tenuous than is normally the case in political discourse. I mean, normally politicians manipulate the passions. We've known that since Plato, right? Plato says political rhetoric is like pastry. The politician is like a pastry cook, offering delicious things that are not nourishing. And he compared the pastry to what he called flattery, pandering. That's what politicians do. They sell themselves in this sort of way. But normally, there's a kind of at least some loyalty to basic considerations of truth, basic epistemic values. And the United States has been ready to tolerate a wholesale departure from that. That's really disturbing and really worrying.
The other thing I wanted to tie in was your work on dehumanization, particularly with some of the policy positions that Donald Trump is advocating, which are in some ways dehumanizing for certain groups of people. How do you fit in what we're dealing with in the U.S. with your work on why we harm people in the way we do as societies?
For the most part, it's not dehumanization in my very strict sense of the term, but it's heading in that direction. So what the picture that Trump gives is they are people, they're not subhuman animals, but they're a different kind of people than us. And they are people who are kind of essentially dangerous to us, right? They are a menacing, dangerous mass that we have to protect ourselves from. This was very clear right at the beginning, the way he characterized Mexicans. Like, you know, they're rapists, and I believe he said they're murderers. And then as an afterthought, some of them are good people, I presume. And now it's Muslims. So it's not dehumanization in my sense. He's not characterizing these people as vermin, although he did characterize ISIS as rats recently. They're still human beings, but they're essentially dangerous human beings that need to be managed, that need to be kept out so they don't harm us. And that's one of his most powerful rhetorical moves, by presenting these people in this sort of way. I mean, that's crack cocaine. You know, if you swallow that, it's a very, very easy idea to get behind and to endorse.
Finally, you said that you were concerned that we might be heading in that direction.
Yeah.
What makes you think that?
I'm very pessimistic about what's going to happen to this country. For many, many years, I've wondered, how is fascism going to come to the USA? And now I understand how it is. So I mentioned that when I first saw Trump and I took him seriously, when I listened to his pattern of rhetoric, my friends kind of dismissed this. He's a clown. He's going to provide entertainment. I could observe all the way through the campaign the tendency to engage in denial. Oh, Trump, he'll never get the Republican nomination. He gets the Republican nomination. Oh, he'll never get elected. And he gets elected. After he gets elected, maybe it won't be so bad. It's that bad. And I think that pattern of denial is still in place. People have great difficulty understanding the seriousness of the situation. I really think we're in danger of American institutions, democratic institutions, the institutions that secure something like a liberal democracy here, being dismantled. So people place their trust, oh, our institutions, they'll keep him in check. Well, you modify the institutions. I think that's what he and his team are working on, and I'm afraid that's going to occur. So deeply pessimistic.
I just taught an American politics course here at the University of Auckland. And one of the things we talked about at the very beginning of the semester was federalism and how there were all these periods in the United States where the federal government would push a policy and some of the states would resist. And in some cases, slavery was one of them. Mm-hmm. They were northern states or cities in the states that refused to comply with the Fugitive Slave Acts, as an example.
Yeah.
I suspect we're going to have a version of that federal government versus state government coming into the future now.
I would not be surprised.
Yeah. Well, David Livingston Smith, I thank you for joining us here on the Scholar Circle again. It's always a pleasure to host you.
It's a pleasure and an honor to be with you.